I'm Brandi Cruz, coming up today on Undivided. In the middle of the night, House Democrats unanimously decided to upend the parental rights initiative. We'll talk about what happens next. Also, a look at the positive of what happened yesterday in Olympia, including the end of a few of the worst criminal justice bills that we've talked about on the show. And the Seattle Times celebrates our attorney general using his resources to thwart ICE efforts to deport criminal illegal aliens. That and much more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided on this Thursday. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I will say, both Nicole and I are pretty tired today, as are a lot of you who stayed up to watch Democrats undermine our democracy and give parents a big middle finger in the middle of the night. Here's what it looked like at 2:30 a.m. when Democrats unanimously voted to upend the parental rights initiative.
Madam Speaker, the state doesn't own our kids. Please vote no on this bill.
Further remarks? Seeing none, the question before the House is final passage of engrossed substitute House Bill 1296.
Madam Speaker, there are 56 yeas, 37 nays, 5 excused.
Having received a constitutional majority, engrossed substitute House Bill 1296 is declared passed.
Every single Democratic member of the State House of Representatives voted to strip away the parental rights that they voted to give you 9 months ago, 10 months ago. That 500,000 people in the state signed an initiative saying they want it. You know, how vile this is. Truly, and I was just thinking this week, Democrats had taken some good votes, I thought, a few Democrats, not all of them. There were a handful of Democrats who I thought, good for them. They'd taken some difficult votes against their own party in the House and the Senate. And I thought, I'm going to make a list this week of all the Democrats who didn't let their state down and their constituents down. And now my list is like at zero. Maybe Bob Ferguson's the only one on my list this week. You know, when I say the word vile, I truly mean that. Because you have to understand, for those of you who haven't followed this debate, how intentional all of this was. How intentional it was to be at this point at 2:30 in the morning and to do this under the cover of darkness. And it's been more than a year in the making. And to reset it before I go through some of the insane stuff said last night that I want people to see, because a lot of you have jobs and have families. You know, while you were tucking your kids in at bed, they were starting the debate to upend your parental rights. Just insane. So for those of you who need a reset, I think for everyone, let's just reset so we understand how egregious this is. You know, the state of Washington has been continually stripping away parental rights for years and years and years on a variety of fronts, including your right to know what's happening with your kids medically and then at school. You know, basically making it so that you drop your kid off at school, and if you do that, you're handing them over to the government and you don't have any say whatsoever in what happens to your kids once they're behind those doors, which is ridiculous, right? Ridiculous. And so now they go in there, they push all this extreme gender ideology and political indoctrination down their throat. You don't get to know any of it. You don't get to see any of it. You don't get to ask about any of it. They'll hook your kids up with medication. They'll diagnose your kids with things, send your kid home. Your kid's acting weird. You have no idea why. And there are a lot of parents in this state, right, left, and center, who aren't okay with that. Understandably so, because it's insane. And this idea that Democrats firmly believe, and I'll play a clip that proves it once and for all, in case anybody was in doubt, that they can parent your kids better than you can, that schools can parent your kids better than you can, that schools can be trusted more so than you to help your child navigate the difficult complexities of growing up in this world. So that led to Let's Go Washington doing a slew of initiatives, including one that was overwhelmingly popular, the Parental Bill of Rights. And what it said simply is parents are the primary stakeholders in their kids' lives. And therefore, they have a right to have access to this information. They have a right to get the curriculum and lessons in a certain period of time. They have a right to know what's happening with their kids, medically speaking, when they go to school and the school connects them with therapists or doctors and your kid might be suicidal and you think that's a good reason that's healthy to hide that from a parent? Or your kid goes to school and they've been indoctrinated by someone in the Olympia school district or whatever it is to believe that they are not the gender that they were born. And so when they go to school, everyone keeps the secret. Tommy is now Tammy at school, and we're going to call Tommy Tammy, but we're not going to tell Tommy's parents that Tommy's going by Tammy at school, because a parent can't be trusted with that information, because parents are all bad, bad people. So this gets 500,000 signatures. And as you know, it was an initiative to the legislature, which meant that the legislature could vote it into law without it going through this process of becoming a ballot measure and voters voting on it in November. And Democrats were very strategic. And honestly, this is a little evil. I think it's evil. There's strategy that's political, and I get it, and that always works its way in. But when you're strategizing a year in advance to screw over parents, that's evil. So they, on a bipartisan basis, overwhelmingly, there were like a few no votes last year. It was completely unanimous in the Senate. They passed the Parental Rights Initiative into law. Yay, look at us. We love parents. We love parents' rights. All the Democrats, like, we're good people. But they did it because they didn't want it to go to voters. They didn't want the initiative to go to voters in a critical election year when there were other initiatives on the ballot that if they passed, they would have stripped hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenue from the state. And so they were worried about the Parental Rights Initiative, which was pretty popular and pretty plain in language, going to voters, and that initiative sort of propping up the other initiatives, like the initiative to repeal capital gains, et cetera, et cetera. So they made a strategic decision. We're going to vote this thing through. And we're going to act like we love parents. All the while, they knew every step of the way that what they would do is come back this legislative session and undo it. They knew it the whole time. And so, you know, a lot of the debate that happened overnight was Democrats saying, well, you know, this parental rights initiative was really confusing. It just confused a lot of things. And this parental rights initiative, you know, violated federal privacy laws. You passed it. So now you're telling on yourself. You're saying that the Parental Rights Initiative was a load of crap, basically, and it confused everybody. You passed it. And so now we obviously know for sure that you passed it knowing you'd come back this year and upend it after the election happened, right? And then you would do it. You would do it. At 2:30 in the morning, they've had weeks to do this. They've had weeks to have this debate in the open, to take a vote in the open. They did this strategically. It was a 6.5-hour debate, and they didn't start it until 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night, after the drive time news, right? After the 5 and 6 o'clock news. And then they voted on it at 2:30 in the morning. And it's all intentional. It's a big slap in the face to parents and a big middle finger to democracy. Because you're talking about upending an initiative. And you know what you're doing. You knew what you were doing all along. You don't care about voters. You don't care about parents. You think you can parent better than the government. So we knew this was going to happen. And it goes over to the Senate. We'll see what happens. This isn't a done deal. But certainly if the House passed it with no Democrats dissenting, I don't see how we'd get a different outcome in the Senate, right? So there were some things said that are just insane. And I think sum up this entire debate. And I want you, if anybody's watching this, who's on the fence about this, like whether the Parental Rights Initiative was a good thing or a bad thing, I want to play for you some of this 6.5-hour debate. And at the end of this segment, I want you to ask yourself, do I feel differently about it now? If you're someone who supports, you know, the upending of parental rights, I want you at the end of this to be able to take a side. And I think it'll be pretty clear what side is on the side of sanity and common sense. So Republicans introduced amendment after amendment after amendment after amendment, just trying to improve this thing. They knew it was going to pass. As the Democrats in control, bring a bill to the floor, last bill before cutoff, not knowing you have the votes, right? So they knew it was going to pass. So they're putting forth some amendments just to try to make it better, right? To try to keep intact some of the most important aspects of the Parental Bill of Rights Initiative. So Representative Michael Keaton, he had an amendment, and it was very smart, actually, very strategic. He actually read, and I'll let him explain it, because he read from the amendment on the floor, and it just very plainly talks about, hey, when parents are involved in their kids' education, outcomes are better. Let's just add this language into this bill. Here he is.
May I read from the amendment?
Please proceed.
The legislature finds that parental involvement is a crucial factor in shaping the educational outcomes of students and contributing to the well-being of society. Parents are the primary stakeholders in their children's upbringing. When parents actively engage in their child's education, it enhances the student's academic performance, motivation, and overall development. Strong parental involvement also fosters a supportive learning environment, both at home and school, helping students develop confidence, resilience, and a sense of responsibility. Moreover, active participation from parents in their child's education builds a stronger school community, promotes positive behavior, and supports the creation of a more equitable learning opportunities. Ultimately, when parents and schools work together, it benefits the individual student and strengthens society by nurtured, educated, responsible, and engaged citizens.
Who would disagree with that? I think that's very nice. Hopefully everybody agrees with that, right? Parents being involved, you know, working with schools to make sure they're bettering academic outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. Let's just add that just as a statement of fact and intent into this bill. And Representative Jim Walsh, as he often does, was able to put it in more layman's terms to understand what the true intent of this was.
Let's agree that parents, broadly defined, are the primary stakeholders in raising children. I believe that that's the spirit of this amendment, and it is an important principle for us to have in our public policy. Parents, not the state, not the government, are the primary stakeholders in raising children. This is important, Mr. Speaker. Please vote yes.
Okay, so that's the amendment we're voting on. Do you believe that parents are the primary stakeholders in their child's lives? Yes or no? Let's watch the vote.
The question before the House is the adoption of Amendment 373. All of those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All of those opposed, say nay.
No.
The amendment is not adopted.
That tells you everything you need to know. It was that simple. Let's add a line. Parents are the primary stakeholder, not the government. Parents are the primary stakeholder in their child's lives. The Democrats voted it down. So if you believe that parents, that you as a parent, are the primary stakeholder in your child's upbringing, then you know who's on your side. If you believe the government is the primary stakeholder in the upbringing of your child, then by all means, like, keep voting for Democrats. That's as simple as it is, and it's as plain as day. They voted against that. So there were a couple other just real crazy things. So one of the, you know, amendments that was talked about is, you know, it's really difficult for local school districts to opt out of some of the craziness that's happening, then that's being pushed on them by the state. And we know that Chris Reichdahl, the superintendent of public instruction, has essentially threatened local school districts who don't buy into and push and teach this radical gender ideology. And so if you don't do it, he's trying to then threatening to strip funding from local school districts. So there was, this was an insane moment. So Rep. Ed Orcutt was talking about an actual example that happened with one of his constituents where their child, and we've talked about many examples like this on the show, where a child is sent home with something disturbing as part of their assignment for class. And a parent only finds out about it because they, you know, went through their kid's backpack or their kid said, hey, look what I got sent home with. And it's very disturbing. It's the first time a parent's finding out that there's something often sexually explicit that their teenager has been sent home with as part of reading material or homework. So Ed Orcutt is giving a fairly descriptive example, right, of something that one of his constituents' children was sent home with and how it's an example of why parents need to have the ability to be alerted and to opt out of assignments like this one.
even when those school boards are opposed to them, when community members are opposed to them, those school boards cannot make the decision on their own, because they are right now under the threat from the superintendent of public instruction of having some of their funding canceled. Imagine the frustration of the parents when they see their kid come home with a comic book. On page 282 of that comic book, there's a graphic of a woman who is naked, and it's showing her from about the ribs down, lying down, her legs in the air, and another person's face between her legs.
Please refrain from such graphic descriptions, and please confine your remarks to the policy.
If it's too graphic for me to talk about here on the floor of the House, is it not too graphic for a teenager to be taking home? Is it not too graphic for the teenager to see this before the parents even get to see it?
That's a good question. And again, if something's too graphic to be talked about in debate by politicians amongst adults on the floor of the state House of Representatives, how can you then turn around and say it's not too graphic to send home with a preteen without their parents knowing about it? This is the kind of stuff that prompted the initiative on the Parental Bill of Rights. What an asinine thing. And you heard the kind of, I mean, it's laughter at that point from Republicans, like, how ridiculous is this? He's giving an actual example of something that happened to a Washington parent. And he's gaveled and told not to be so graphic on the floor of the House. Because it's laughable, right? If an adult can't talk about it, why should a child be given it? And of course, they rejected that amendment. The Democrats did. Nicole, can we jump ahead to the Jim Walsh on gender identity thing quick? So there's these examples of just blatantly ridiculous stuff, right? That just prove the point of why we need a parental bill of rights. And this is one of them. So Representative Jim Walsh is trying to get to, again, they're pushing all these amendments. Let's try to improve this. He's trying to get to this term gender expansive, which actually is a coincidence, because on the show yesterday, I'm like, what does that even mean? Like, what is gender expansive? And so he's saying we need to further define that when we talk about the protections for gender expansive students. Like, what does that really mean? So here he is talking about an amendment that would narrow that to only human-based gender identities.
Our law has no clear definition of what gender expansive means. And we know, having heard from parents and families and school administrators, that in some places, some children consider their gender identity to include non-human characteristics, that their notion of gender includes animal characteristics, a dog or a cat. And so what this amendment does is it narrows this definition of gender expansive expression to human gender.
Sounds fair, right? Like, hey, let's, cool, gender expansive, leave that stuff in, different gender identities. We know you're not going to strip that out. So, you know, if somebody wants to, boy, girl, they, them, whatever it is, multiple people even, fine. But if they identify as a dog or a cat or a mythical beast of some kind, I think schools ought to try to bring them back to some semblance of a human identity, right? Well, not according to Democrats, because there are some good reasons not to do that.
I think we've talked before about my son. He is autistic with selective mutism, and communication is really hard for him. One of the things that makes it a lot easier is when he doesn't have to use words. And when he's happy and he greets me, sometimes he'll be wagging his imaginary tail. Or he'll growl when he's unhappy.
I give up. That sounds like a parenting problem, to be honest. And it also sounds like something we're going to want to try to get going in the right direction. And look, I understand that kids have learning disabilities, but the fact that your son, who has some issues, growls at you occasionally is not cause to leave in a definition that could include students who want to identify as animals. So they rejected this amendment. And one of the things that Democratic lawmaker also said is she said that this amendment was all built on a lie, that there were school, there was a school in the Midwest there that they were putting litter boxes in the bathroom for kids. And she was basically saying it's a total lie manufactured by the right that these students are identifying as animals, which, as you know, it's not a lie. We've done stories in the not too distant past about with pictures of kids at schools dressed as animals, like they have little furry clubs because, of course, social contagion. So one comes in wearing a ears and a tail and the rest of them are now hopping around acting like cats or other mythical beasts. Like, shouldn't we all be able to agree that, hey, gender expansive, we're in a progressive state, you know, people are transgender, whatever it is, but we're not going to encourage children who want to wear tails and hop around. But apparently not. That's how extreme Washington Democrats are. Couldn't even support that amendment. So those are the obvious ones where it's sort of like, well, that's just ridiculous. Some things that happened last night were a little less obvious, but almost proved our point in a better way. And I want to play one of those for you because I don't think it will get played anywhere else. So there was an amendment that talked about discipline. So we know that our schools have gotten very lax on disciplinary measures against kids because, you know, can't do that. Kid causing problems in the classroom, repeatedly impacting the learning of other students, and they don't do anything about it. So we can't discipline kids. That's wrong, right? And in the eyes of Democrats, this is a Republican amendment. Hey, we need to make sure that if students are repeatedly causing disciplinary issues that are impacting the learning of other students, that that's taken seriously. So, but the Democratic argument is the same as it has been. It's why OSPI doesn't really discipline kids, because in the eyes of Democrats, discipline ends up just being racist. Here's a clip.
Evidence showed that it disproportionately impacted African-American students, particularly African-American boys. They were being denied their educational opportunity.
Which is because more African-American boys were having disciplinary issues. You know, it's like this, and I'm going to get to the gotcha moment in a second, but basically, oh, we can't institute harsher discipline because it'll disproportionately impact young black men, as if it's the system being racist and teachers being racist and schools being racist by disciplining a disproportionate number of young black men. And they don't want to entertain the possibility that there's a disproportionate number of young black men who are engaged in problematic behavior at schools. And how can we deal with that besides just ignoring it because, oh, it's racist? Because they've got to say you got like 10 boys in front of you and they're all acting up. Well, only you, whitey, you three white kids, you go to the principal's office. We'll take one black kid, you go to the principal's office. One Asian kid, come with us. The rest of you are off the hook because if we disciplined all of you, we would be disciplining a disproportionate number of people of color. Like, that's really the way their mind works. Because it's disproportionate, because you have more young black men who have disciplinary issues in our schools, apparently, disproportionate number, then you just let them off the hook, as if that's going to fix the problem, right? It's just the stupidest argument. So this state lawmaker goes on to totally tell on herself and actually makes the Republican argument, the parental rights argument here. So she's saying, rather than institute harsher discipline in our schools, right? Let me tell you what, you know, once our state realized, oh, this is racist, we can't continue this disciplinary action that we're doing because it impacts young black kids. She says the state took a lot of steps to improve this situation. And she gives an example of what her school district did that worked so well.
A number of things occurred. They created the Oversight and Accountability Committee. They gave teachers more training on classroom management. And in my community, Madam Speaker, parents created the South King County Discipline Coalition. And through this work, we have found that we are improving the the educational opportunities for all students.
Wait a second, did I hear that right? So parents got involved and helped the schools improve educational opportunities and outcomes for students. So a problem in our schools, in your schools, was solved by increased participation from parents. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the whole purpose behind the Parental Bill of Rights. Yet that Democratic lawmaker in that moment didn't even notice that she was making that argument. It's crazy to me. So a lot of stuff happened, ended with the vote, of course. One of the things that was discussed over and over, and I just have to talk about it because it made national news when it was first being discussed, and there's so many good examples of why we needed it. You remember when this bill was in committee and Republicans were trying to change some language in the bill that Democrats had put in the bill that if something happens to your kid at school, basically, or let's say they're accusing a teacher of sexually assaulting them or some other thing happens, that instead of saying you have to tell parents immediately, it was you have to tell parents at the first available opportunity or at least within 48 hours. And Republicans are like, within 48 hours? Why would you give them 48 hours to tell a parent that a teacher might have sexually assaulted their child? And that just blew up all over nationally because Democrats rejected it. And so there were some amendments attempting to fix that situation. Like, hey, we can't wait 48 hours to tell a parent that something serious has either happened to their child or their child is making a serious accusation against a teacher or a staff member. So that debate was happening again on the floor. And Democrats kept claiming that, like, that doesn't happen. That, of course, schools are going to get in touch with parents ASAP. And I could not help but think of a story that came out yesterday that proves the exact point of schools can't be trusted to do that anymore. Did you hear about this tragic, oh my God, just heartbreaking story? So there's an immigrant family in Seattle Public Schools, and their 12-year-old child, Arsima McConan, was outside Washington Middle School with some classmates during what they call second lunch, which I'm not sure what second lunch is. So there was a vehicle, and the driver of that vehicle, 51-year-old, left it in a no parking zone, and the vehicle backed into her and killed this 12-year-old instantly. And so this had happened a couple days ago. Just horrible story, right? So what would be your expectation? Your child, 12-year-old, whatever age, goes to school and they get killed at school, okay? Of course the school's going to call you right away. Of course the school's going to be like, what can we do? Oh my gosh, this is a tragedy, right? Well, according to Cairo 7, which interviewed this deceased child's parents, at the time of the interview, by the time it aired, Seattle Public Schools had still not reached out to the family of a dead 12-year-old yet.
Heartbroken by this tragedy.
Seattle School Superintendent Brent Jones spoke to reporters soon after the accident, but Arsima's parents say neither he nor anyone else with the school district has reached out to them.
They were just left here to fend for themselves and figure out the rest.
Now they feel betrayed by their adopted country.
I brought my daughter from Ethiopia here to have a better life, to go to a better school, get better education, and then I send my child to school and I don't get my child back.
That's disgusting. Immigrants to this country came here for a better life. 12-year-old hit and killed by a car outside the school days ago. Seattle Public Schools didn't as much as a phone call to the parents to express their condolences, to ask how can we help, what can we do for you. And Democrats in Olympia want us to believe that it's not a problem in the law to give schools 48 hours to contact parents if something happens to their kids. And look, did police do it? Of course. You know, of course police were in touch with these parents. Their child had just been killed. But not so much as a phone call, email even, from the school. And when Cairo 7 asked the school why not, they basically said, we're working on it. Working on it. What do you mean? Because the school, and this speaks to the reason why Democrats would not strengthen that wording in the bill. You know why the school didn't contact those parents? You know exactly why. They're worried about getting sued. They wanted to be careful about what they said so they could avoid responsibility. So they didn't contact the parents. probably until they ran past what they were going to say with their attorneys. And that's the reason why Democrats in Olympia don't want schools to have to immediately reach out to parents if a child makes an accusation of sexual assault or something from a teacher. It's not because they want to give the police time to do their jobs, as they have said previously. No, it's because they want time to cross their T's and dot their I's and make sure that whatever they say to parents won't get them sued, because they care more about a lawsuit than they do about parents and parental rights and doing the right thing. And that just encompasses this whole debate. It's insane to me, after we play all of that, after we talked about all of this, that there could be any parent, one parent, in the state of Washington who would support what Democrats did last night. I don't know how one parent who has all of the information could support what Democrats did last night. And I'll tell you what, there are a whole hell of a lot of parents among the Democratic caucus in the House who did this to other parents. You think for one second that those Democrats would like it if anything like this happened to their kid and happened to them? If their child was accusing a teacher of sexual assault and the school didn't contact them for 2 days, you think a single one of those Democrats who took that vote would be happy about that? Of course not. But if it happens to your kid, that's just fine. Your kid sent home with pornography as a reading assignment, they don't care. If their kid was sent home with something they didn't agree with, maybe a Bible verse, they'd lose their minds. They don't care about you. They don't care about your kids. They don't care about you as a parent. They don't care about your household. They want kids in this state to be raised in their image, with their ideology, by their biggest campaign donors, the Washington Education Association. That's what all of it is about. And parents are in the way. And that's what they showed us last night. So the fight on this isn't over. I realize I talked about it for 40 minutes. The fight on this isn't over. There's two versions of this that are still alive. The Senate version sits in a House committee. The House version is going to get sent over to a Senate committee. And we'll see if they decide to push one of these forth. If they do, as you know, Let's Go Washington has already pre-filed an initiative to unravel it. So that will be the next assignment, essentially. If they decide to push this through, Let's Go Washington will immediately launch an initiative. We'll have to get it out to as many people as possible. And we will drain the bankrolls of the Washington Education Association as they fight against it. At the end of the day, if all that's all that happens is we cost them tens of millions of dollars having to fight against another initiative, well, so be it. Insane stuff. Let me give you a little bit of good news, though. We'll go through this kind of quick. There were some of the bills that we talked about on the show repeatedly over the last 2 months, specifically on the criminal justice front. Some of the real, real loco stuff is now dead. Let's tick through some of it. House Bill 1399. This is the bill that essentially would have given the state more control over your duly elected sheriff in your county. Because what they want is sheriffs not to be elected. They actually want sheriffs to be appointed. And they don't want any of these constitutional sheriffs who are going to fight back against vaccine mandates or not enforce some of the gun laws the ICE enforcements. They want to help ICE. They don't want those sheriffs. That's really what 1399 was about. However, it is now dead. It did not meet the cutoff. So I think that's very good news. A lot of credit to sheriffs across the state who pushed back against this. But Sheriff Derek Sanders in Thurston County was one of the big, big drivers of defeating this. So good for him. Also, Senate Bill 5266, amen, is dead. This is the bill that would have let juvenile killers, even if you killed two people, out of prison early. And then we would have had to pay for their rent. Just insane that it was even crafted by anyone with a brain. And then this is good news for crime victims and families of crime victims. House Bill 1125 and House Bill 1178, dead and dead. House Bill 1125 is the one that would have given crazy activist judges discretion to end lengthy prison sentences early in the interest of justice. And then House Bill 1178 would have been the one that would have reduced sentencing enhancements for things like gun crimes, gang crimes, and adults who cook meth around kids. So dead, dead, dead. Dead. So those are some wins, right? We can take the good with the bad. There's a lot of bad. So we got to celebrate the good ones when they happen. All right. Much more to discuss. to discuss, including an interview with Representative Jim Walsh, who is also the chair of the Washington State Republican Party, about what went down on the floor last night, and also a voter integrity lawsuit that he is part of. First, Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwer Capital is having another one of their Know Your Risk live webinars coming up on March 20th of this month at 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. So this is going to be about taking folks through the first 100 days of the Trump administration and helping you kind of understand what's happening in the stock market right now. It's been a little bit rough, right? And so should you be worried about it? Should you be panicking if you're getting close to retirement? Well, Zach can answer all those questions for you. It's totally free. It's just sort of an informative webinar to go over things that are happening under the Trump administration and also for the rest, kind of a longer term outlook for 2025. Plus, you'll get a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, give your retirement as much upside as possible. So you can run your portfolio through a Department of Retirement Efficiency. Sign up for the free live webinar, knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. Again, it's happening on March 20th. Okay, so as I had mentioned, a lot happening on the floor. God bless the Republican lawmakers. Not a single Democrat gets credit on the House side who stayed up so late trying to push back against this insanity. One of them was State Representative Jim Walsh. He's also the chair of the Washington State Republican Party. We'd actually scheduled to tape with him this morning on a different topic. He is actively trying to fight against the state's motor voter law, which basically says when you get your driver's license, they register you to vote without any due diligence to make sure you're actually legally allowed to vote. And so he has a court case on that today, but we also, of course, talked about everything that went down on the floor last night. Representative Walsh, welcome back to Undivided.
Good to talk to you, Brandy. What a night it was last night.
I got to ask you, not to offend you, you're a little bit older than me. I couldn't even stay awake. How'd you stay awake?
I'm sort of accustomed to it. This period of about 10 days before the midpoint of each legislative session is kind of the hell week. It is 8 to 10 days of heavy floor actions, of floor debates, floor votes, and it usually goes for, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. So I think I've become conditioned to it, where I'm used to sleep deprivation and needing to stay sharp on the floor. There's also some caffeine.
Yeah, I saw some members drinking regular Coca-Cola, which I'll have to talk to them about because that's not very good for you.
No, I drink Cascade Ice, which is a
local company.
A local caffeinated soda water brand that is a little bit better than some of the other stuff.
This segment brought to you by Cascade Ice.
There you go.
Right. But in all seriousness, I'm a skeptic, I think, by nature. That's part of the job. And I think you probably are as well a little bit. Is there any good reason or less nefarious reason why this particular bill had to wait until the last day of cutoff and be voted on at 2:30 a.m.?
To some degree, Brandy, it's a flex on the part of the speaker. The so-called 5 o'clock bill, which is the last bill of the before the big cutoff at the midpoint section of the session, is a statement that the Speaker of the House can make. And I think she was making a statement by holding this bill to be the so-called 5 o'clock bill, the last bill out of the Chamber of Origin period of the leg session.
But what statement is that?
That this is an important issue to her, maybe the most important issue of the session to her, repealing and gutting and undoing the Parents' Bill of Rights. There was also apparently a little bit of back and forth between the Democrats in the State House and the Democrats in the State Senate over whose version of the bill to gut the Parents' Bill of Rights would be the vehicle, as they call it, the version that would go to the governor's desk. And that's undetermined because both the Senate and the House passed out slightly different versions of bills to undo the Parents' Bill of Rights. Although the one that we voted on last night in the House ended up really being substantially similar to the one that the Senate voted out about a week or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, you know, we've seen some votes lately in the House. I mean, obviously, Democrats have this huge majority, so I don't think either of us anticipated this being voted down. They wouldn't have probably brought it to the floor otherwise. But it was every single Democrat. I guess there was a small part of me that was surprised that there weren't any Democrats who voted against it. Were you surprised?
Uh, Yes, I was. I expected, as you saw in some of the votes on different amendments during the long floor debate, the speaker did let a few of her vulnerable members whose districts clearly do not agree with the far left lean of the majority of the Democrats in Olympia. She let a few of them vote with the Republicans on some of the amendments. But when it came to the final passage of the bill to gut the Parents' Bill of Rights, it looks like the speaker insisted all of her members vote to gut the Parents' Bill of Rights. And that is undoubtedly going to cost some of her vulnerable members who represent districts that are more purple than deep blue come next fall.
Well, one can only hope, right? So I know that this fight isn't over. We'll see which version, if any, make it to the governor's desk. And then, of course, there's an initiative on deck should they choose to go that route. Let's talk about the motor voter law. You're in court today?
Yes. I myself am not, but our lawyer representing the state party and many groups, including Republicans and non-Republican groups around the state, is in court down in Clark County in Vancouver today. We're pursuing this case that involves, to some degree, the state's motor voter, that is the automatic voter registration program that we have in law in Washington State, but also a specific election from last year, a state Senate election down in Clark County that was decided by about 180 votes. And we found at least 500 votes cast in that election that were cast improperly. The people who voted no longer live in the district. And in Washington State, you have to live in the district where you're voting in order to vote legally. These were people, mostly people who had lived in the district earlier, but moved elsewhere, but still voted in that election in last November. That is illegal. Now, it's not the kind of thing people usually go to jail for doing, but it does call the result of that election into some question. And more to the point, Brandy, we're making a case for how poorly managed and maintained and updated the voter databases, the so-called voter rolls, are in the state of Washington. And we just found basically a smoking gun. There is no doubt that the voter database in that legislative race, the 18th legislative district, again, Clark County, Washington, the database is just not managed properly. There were too many people who'd moved away who were still listed as registered voters in that district.
Can I stop you for a sec, Jim, just so I'm not confused, because there's a couple issues at play there, right? So there's people who are voting in a district they no longer live in. I mean, that a city council member did that in Linwood and was voting in a district he didn't live in and representing a district he didn't live in, and nobody's doing anything about that. But so that's going on. But how is that tied to the motor voter law?
Well, it's our argument that there are several practices that lead to this poorly maintained voter database status quo that we have in Washington. And one of them is the automatic voter registration. In Washington State, when you go to get a driver's license or even a non-driver's license ID card from the State Department of Licensing, you are automatically registered to vote at the address you're putting on your driver's license unless you affirmatively say, "Don't register me." We believe that is a bad practice. There's no due diligence done to make sure that that is in fact the address where you live. It's not like a temporary address for a kid at school or something. There is no due diligence done to make sure you're in fact a legal voter. You're a citizen who is allowed to vote. There's no quality control on that automatic voter registration. And we are arguing that that and a couple of other practices encourage and lead to these incorrect voter databases with people who are not properly able to vote, who are on the database as registered voters in a particular area. And the key thing here is, Brandy, because we're an all mail-in voting state, those databases are super important because we mail the ballots out to the names and addresses on the database. And if they're wrong, We're sending ballots out to the wrong people in the wrong places, and that's just a recipe for, not integrity or not enough integrity.
Yeah, what do you think happened with those 500? Because, again, if you mail the ballot and they're not there, does the USPS forward it to their current address, or are you contending that people who lived in the places that those people used to live voted for them?
It's kind of all of the above. In some cases, the ballots were, it looks like, were forwarded to a person's new address. That's not supposed to happen, but we know that it does happen in many cases. And then in other cases, we don't know. It may have been someone else voted the ballot. In some cases, the people may have been wrongly on the database to begin with, and they aren't, in fact, legal voters. So we think it's a mix of different problems, but the main piece of it seems to be that ballots were forwarded improperly to people at their new addresses, and they voted them either knowingly or unknowingly, that to vote based on their old address where they don't live anymore is actually against the law.
Yeah. So what is the outcome that you're hoping for? Because I know that you guys have also asked the Trump administration and Attorney General Pam Bondi to review this sort of motor voter law here. But in terms of today's court hearing, in this case, what is the outcome that you want?
Well, we're asking for a couple of remedies. One would be we're asking the court to order a new election in the one that was affected by the 500 questionable ballots. If we can't get that, we at least want an acknowledgement from the court that this, in fact, happened. Because when we raise questions of election integrity in Washington state, we're often countered with this argument, prove there's a problem. So we think that in this race, we have a smoking gun. We have proof of a problem. And at least we want the court to acknowledge the problem. If they won't order a new election, we at least want an acknowledgement that this problem happened. And that way we can really, I think, get traction on some of our other requests for better election integrity. And yes, on a separate track, but related, we have asked the Trump administration in DC to look particularly into how Washington state implements the automatic voter registration, the so-called Motor Voter Act. And we believe that the implementation is even worse than it needs to be. Other states have the so-called motor voter registration programs, but the other states generally do some kind of checking, some kind of due diligence that the people being automatically registered are legal voters. Washington doesn't do it. And so we're asking the Trump administration and the Department of Justice, Attorney General Bondi, perhaps the FBI, to come and investigate, look into how Washington state does the motor voter automatic registration. And we believe there are problems in it, and there may be some federal laws being violated in terms of voting rights for people. And if so, we're asking them to take some action to kind of clean up how Washington does automatic voter registration.
Yeah, and really quick, just because we're out of time, but just so I don't misunderstand this issue, because it seems like there's a clear problem with it. You're basically, it's like scout's honor. I can vote, right? Because you have to sort of opt yourself out of being registered, which of course raises the question of someone who's not a legal citizen in this country. My understanding is, yes, if they choose to vote and they're not a legal citizen, that's a crime that they could be prosecuted for, but somebody would have to kind of flag it in order for there to be an inquiry, right? There's no automatic comparison against a database of citizens.
That is correct. There is no automatic due diligence in the system as we implement it here in Washington state. In theory, the state secretary of state should be the entity, the office doing that. They aren't. They're kind of pointing the fingers at the 39 county auditors who are the local authorities for elections. And so there's a lot of finger pointing going on between the county auditors and the state secretary of state. And what we're asking the Trump administration to do is, we don't care. We just want clarity on who should be doing the quality control, making sure that people who are registered to vote are actually legal to vote and live where we think they live.
Huh. Makes sense, doesn't it? Representative Walsh, good job on the floor last night / this morning. You're always really great in your arguments for amendments. And there were some crazy moments we highlighted on the show today. But thanks for trying. I know you guys are outnumbered, but all you can do is try.
We're not giving up, Brandy. We're not giving up. We are going to keep pushing for better law and better policy. And kids, I mean, at the end of the day, the stuff about parents' rights is ultimately about schools being better at delivering good education to kids. That's what the end goal is.
Couldn't agree more. All right, Representative Walsh, thanks so much.
Good to talk to you.
So we'll stay up to date on that lawsuit. It seems kind of a reasonable thing. Like, there has to be some checking here. It can't just be scouts honor. So we'll tell you what happens there. We'll follow up with that next week. And again, I mean, you know, Jim Walsh tried pretty hard on the floor to get them to accept some of these common sense amendments, and they just weren't interested in doing so. All right, we've got a pretty tough story coming up next. And in fact, we were both told about it last night. I got a call from our friend Ari Hoffman over at KVI because he knows how much this case means to Nicole and to Dory Monson. And so he called. I know he talked to Nicole as well. And then we heard from one of the family members involved. We have found out that Governor Inslee, on his way out the door, signed off on the release of a triple murderer from a horrific case in 1980. So we're going to discuss what happened there. And again, Governor Jay Inslee's parting FU to crime victims. First, if you're thinking about selling your home at some point this year, reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Right now, I mean, this is a seller's market. There's a lot of pent-up demand out there. And so if your home hits the market, it's priced right, it's prepared for sale, those are the homes that are performing the best and being sold the fastest. So Wes Jones can help you with all of that. He's going to start with a free market analysis. So it kind of sets your expectations. He's going to go through the house, see and recommend what he thinks might need to be done to make sure you can get the best possible offers for your home. He can even help you manage those projects up front, and then you don't have to pay for it until closing, which I think is a pretty cool, stress-free way to go about it. So reach out to our friend Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com. He says the rest of this month and May are going to be top months of the year to list a home. So get going on it. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. So this is horrifying. And again, I'll have Nicole come in a moment to talk about it because it was a case and a story that she and Dory, before Dory passed away, talked quite a bit about. So back in 1980, there was a horrific triple murder, but it would have been the murder of five people had the killer been successful. So a man named Timothy Pauley and another individual he was with went into, and again, this is 1980. So it was at the Barn Door Tavern. And a man named Lauren Dowell, who was there, his coworker Bob Pierre, they were robbed. They were tied up in the walk-in cooler. This is in SeaTac at Barn Door Tavern, again, 1980. Both of them were shot in the back of the head. And then also the killers tried to hang the others who were in there and succeeded in hanging and killing Bob Pierre's girlfriend, Linda Burford. And then Lauren's wife, Margaret, and a cook there, Sherry Beckham, managed to survive. And, I mean, just horrible details, like stripped naked, tortured, tied with electrical cords, and then left for dead in the restroom by Pauley and Pauley's accomplice, Scott Smith. So that's the crime, right? That's as heinous gets. So there have been a couple times over the last decade that Timothy Pauley has tried to get early release. So back in 2016, Timothy Pauley had asked for early release. And actually at the time, think about how disconnected this is from where we are today. So the state's Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board at the time had actually said, not only are we not going to let you out early, but you have to serve two additional decades because the parole board at the time decided that his original sentence was too lax. Think about that. That's only in 2016. That's less than 10 years ago. He comes to them asking for parole, and they give him two additional decades. Well, then you fast forward to 2022, and there was another request from Timothy Pauley and his defense team to get out of prison. And of course, Governor Jay Inslee was in office. And at the time, the parole board, in essence, in Washington State, granted it. And they said that Timothy Pauley could get out of prison early. And there was this immense backlash. A lot of it led by Dory Monson and Lauren's family. His daughters, Angie and Kelly, were really outspoken. And there was enough pressure on Governor Inslee where when that order came to his desk, he denied it. This is just in 2022, and he decided to keep Timothy Pauley in prison. So this is what we find out last night, that Governor Inslee, on his way out the door, rescinded that denial. He issued an order basically saying that, you know, here's the decision he made in 2022. And then he put in here, you know, his rationale. I guess I'll read it for you. It says, the May 2022 cancellation order I issued explained my deep concern that Mr. Pauly failed to affirmatively demonstrate both a full acceptance of his responsibility and remorse for the crimes he committed in 1980. Since that time, Mr. Pauly has engaged in extensive work to address my concerns, and I am satisfied that there is now adequate evidence of his full acceptance and remorse. Yeah, right. It says, accordingly, I rescind my cancellation order dated May 18th, 2022, and reinstate the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board's decision to grant parole release to Mr. Timothy Pauly, as written in their April 4th, 2022 decision and reasons. Consequently, I remand this matter to the ISRB to complete release proceedings in this matter. Now, we're told as of today, Timothy Pauly is not out yet, but his release is imminent. Obviously, the family of his victims are incredibly distraught. Nicole, can we share the news about Margaret? Is that okay?
I think so.
So as we said, Lauren's wife, Margaret, survived this attack and lived, you know, with the horror of what happened to them that day and what happened to her that day and the loss of her husband when they had children, and then had to relive it every time that Timothy Pauly would come to the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board and ask for release, had to relive it in 2016, had to relive it and fight in 2022 when the board granted him release and finally, you know, Inslee denied it. So we were told by Lauren's daughters that Margaret died. Margaret has passed away. And she died a day before the family found out that Timothy Pauly is going to be released.
Well, I think they found out that he was going to be released
the day before she was buried.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just horrible. And I don't know if they ended up telling Margaret if she knew when she passed away.
I believe she passed away already. So I'm...
It's just horrible for that family. And I mean, they're obviously really distraught. So now they're dealing with the imminent release of Timothy Pauly. And here's Jay Inslee. He gets to play kind of hero, denying the board's order. And then on his way out the door, what reason is there, may I ask? What reason would there ever be to grant early release to someone who murdered three people in the most heinous fashion and tried to kill two more? I mean, stripped the women naked, tortured them, tied them up, killed one of them by hanging, put the two men in a freezer, shot them in the back of the head. What reason in the world would there ever be to grant an individual like that early release and to do it, the big middle finger on your way out the door? And our understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the one who spoke to the family this morning, is that Inslee did not consult with them.
Nope.
There was no call from the governor saying, hey, I've reconsidered my 2022 order and we're going to let him out. Don't you think that would be at the bare minimum what having a conscience would demand of you?
And they have met with Inslee multiple times, I believe. So they had, I mean, they had had a relationship with him. And when they announced this in 2022, we were very thankful.
They were
very complimentary of Inslee, and the family didn't want to say a lot of negative because they felt heard by him. And just to do this on your way out the door without even telling them, it's so evil.
No conscience, no soul, no remorse, nothing. It's disgusting. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely disgusting. And I can't imagine being in that position. And this happens more and more to crime victims, where, you know, you think there's finality for you in terms of, I mean, you're always living with this, I imagine. But you think that, okay, this person is going to be in prison probably until he dies because, you know, of old age or whatever it is. And then it's like, you never get finality.
Constant
revictimization. 100% every single time. And even more so when they don't tell you. How could you not have even an ounce of... like, I mean, not remorse, I guess, for the governor, but like humanity to just pick up the phone and own that decision. Own that decision. You have a lot of power as governor in cases like these. With a flick of your pen, you can let someone who did something so heinous out of prison. How could you not have an ounce of humanity to call the family personally and tell them what you're going to do? I already knew Jay Inslee was a bad person, but that just cements it for me. Absolutely disgusting.
If you truly believe that he has rehabilitized himself and
rehabilitated.
Really? Yeah. Or gotcha. Ties. Whatever. But if you truly believe he is rehabilitated and is safe for the public to be around, then call the family and put them at ease. Right. Why are you hiding it? Why are you Why are you not willing to tell them what all the things that you think he's accomplished in prison?
Right.
I don't believe that at all.
Who's going to hold him accountable? He's out the door, mm-hmm. right? So it's the last flick of the pen out the door, like screw this family. And then their mom dies. And, you know, I can't even imagine what they're going through right now. So absolutely. I mean, think about the families and hold them in your thoughts and prayers, because no one in the state government is thinking about them. Mm-hmm. Governor Inslee, as he's off probably jetting to some climate conference somewhere, isn't thinking about them. So just horrible, horrible news. Was devastated to hear that. I know, Nicole, you and Dory fought so hard against that, and Dory would have been devastated to hear this as well. So absolutely just atrocious. All right, I think we can fit in a quick unbelievable. Maybe we'll shorten it a little bit. The Seattle Times just fawning with praise for Attorney General Nick Brown and his lawsuit to try to stop a local sheriff from helping ICE deport violent criminals. Just insane. So you probably saw this. We talked about it on the show. The Attorney General's office is suing Adams County and the Adams County Sheriff because the Sheriff Adams County came out and said, hey, we're going to help ICE. When they're trying to get dangerous people off the streets, we're going to assist ICE in that effort. We think that that's the right thing to do. But of course, Adams County is still in Washington State, which is a sanctuary county. Nick Brown had said in a lawsuit, he filed it on March 10th, that the Adams County Sheriff's Office illegally collaborated with federal immigration officials in aiding the Trump administration's efforts to enlist local officials for federal civil immigration work. So they're so mad about it that they're going to use their time and energy to sue. The Adams County Sheriff had come back with a press release basically saying, look, I'm the sheriff. My top priority is ensuring the safety and security of our residents. He called the lawsuit filed by the state attorney general a disappointing attempt to hinder our ability to uphold public safety. And I gotta say, I agree with him. I agree with him. And it's ridiculous. We talked about it on the show quite a bit, which is, if you care about public safety, how does that stop at helping ICE get like murderers and child rapists out of the country? But in this state, we're so woke, right? So now all the other things going on, all the other things, and Attorney General Nick Brown, who wanted all of us to think he's a moderate, now using the time and energy and your money to sue Adams County. Here is the take from the Seattle Times editorial board. They are a disappointment to society. AG's lawsuit against Adams County protects civil rights and the economy. Ah, yes, because we should put the economy ahead of public safety and child rapists. We should put the economy ahead of deporting child rapists and the economy ahead of deporting wanted murderers. So their take is ridiculous. It says Brown's role is to protect the rights of all Washington residents and is right to do so under the Keep Washington Working Act. Adams County's major industry is agriculture. One would think county officials would want to abide by a law that helps protect an industry and people whose contributions are so important to the local region. I love multiple times in this op-ed, they're talking about how the Adams County Sheriff thumbed his nose at the rule of law. Is our state not thumbing its nose at federal law? They're doing, if your problem is with someone not following the law, I mean, you're literally making it more difficult for federal immigration agents to carry out the law. But again, this is such a simplistic, I don't know if simplistic is the word, it's such a twisted interpretation of what's happening here. They want to act like Adams County is out there in the fields, in the apple orchards or whatever it is, like rounding people up because of their skin tone and checking their papers. No, this is about cooperating with ICE immigration holds. Our lights are flickering a little bit over there. You see that? Okay, if we lose power again, we're not coming back. We're not coming back. I think this storm kind of passed, though. I mean, it was raging. Anyway,
that was crazy.
You're not out there. That's not what we're talking about. Adams County isn't doing that. So you are acting as if, what, do we have, are these child rapists that ICE is rounding up and these kidnappers and murderers? I mean, they've, all measure of criminals, they've taken off the streets of Seattle and beyond. So people who have killed law enforcement, who have resisted arrest, all this stuff. Are you saying that, like, the only immigrants we have in Adams County are, like, the immigrants who are law-abiding? It's so strange to me because there's so much gray area in there and they want to be like, you're upholding the law and you're protecting a major industry in Adams County. You can protect that industry and still honor ICE detainers for violent criminals. You do see how we can do both of those things. But it's just all the stuff happening in Olympia, all the stuff we've talked about on the show happening in Olympia, all the pro-crime bills, all of this. And this is what the Seattle Times editorial board, in utter embarrassment, decides to write about, praising AG Nick Brown for thwarting efforts to get violent criminals off our street. They've really lost their damn minds. All right, let's see. It's Thursday, after all. We're going to skip a couple national stories just because, you know, we had a power outage and getting a little late here. But we cannot skip checking in on what's happening in the Sunshine State. It is our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, hello.
Hello.
Hi. All right, so what about the media, which I'm not 100% sure how I feel about it. I think the headline makes it sound worse than it is, but it has to do with removing certain protections for people like me in Florida who might make a little oopsie in their reporting.
Yes, exactly. So Senate Bill 752 would basically open up journalists and the news agencies to basically getting sued.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Make them liable for misinformation if it's not removed as soon as it becomes known that the information they reported is not accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I get it because the news happens quickly and you report what you can as information comes out. And a lot of times that information does change, but I do still think it's important for media outlets and journalists to be able to go back and redact and change stories to be accurate as they find out more.
Yeah, this one's weird to me because, I mean, there's a lot of protections for the media because of the First Amendment. And as long as you're sort of doing your job in good faith, the idea is honest mistakes happen and you can't sue the media every time there's an honest mistake. But so that's why I say, you know, the headline makes it sound like, oh, you're just going Republicans in Florida going after the press. But the argument they're making is if something is proven to be false and the media won't retract it or edit it and it just stays up, then you should be able to be sued for libel. And I guess I'm surprised that that's not already allowed. If I post a story that's untrue about someone, and even in the face of evidence that it's not true, I refuse to take it down, yeah, you should sue me for libel. So I guess I don't see what's like controversial about that.
Well, apparently one of the examples they used was a very specific instance where a Miami man was accused of a crime that he ended up not being guilty of. And when this man's lawyer asked all these news outlets to take the stories down or change them, all but one did. So one news outlet apparently refused to take down articles accusing this man of a crime he didn't commit. So I guess when you do get a stubborn news outlet, there has to be some sort of way for this, like a person who's being misrepresented, to have defense.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't make any sense to just say, oh, the media is because of the First Amendment. They can just print lies. You can't. And we've seen examples nationally of media outlets get sued for hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, they even issued apologies and they were still able to get sued, or they issued retractions and they were still able to get sued because of the damage it did to someone's reputation. So the media has a lot of protection, but we're not perfect. And if we don't act in good faith, then absolutely people should be able to sue us. I always act in good faith, however, always. all right, Doge hitting Florida. So apparently in Everglades National Park, of course, and this is one of the things I've heard sort of bipartisan concern about, are national parks and park rangers losing their jobs because of the work of Doge. So people are worried about some park rangers losing their job in the Florida Everglades, but it's actually not very much in comparison to how many work there, right?
Yeah, and it was funny because when I had read this article, it talked about how 15, specifically in the Everglades National Park, 15 people have lost their jobs. And these are people employed by the park that do anything from cleaning restrooms, trash removal, all the way to fighting wildfires and testing water. So it's a big range of people that are employed at the national park. And I had to really do some digging to find out how many people actually work for the national park. And I found about 2,300 people are employed.
So 15 lost their jobs?
So 15 lost their jobs, which sucks. I can't imagine being a person that loses my job through all this. But I think with that many employees, it's kind of not that it's not a big deal, but of course a few people are gonna lose their jobs thinking that they're, you know, maybe overstaffed in certain areas.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't want to be flippant about people losing their jobs. That sucks. And we're going to have people in Washington State who have and will continue to lose their jobs for the federal government. But if you have an entity that can cut a little bit of the workforce, I mean, we're talking about taxpayer dollars. So at the end of the day, I mean, 15 out of that many doesn't seem all that significant unless you're the person who lost your job. However, Florida has a big invasive species problem. And these Everglades workers, federal workers, are some of the ones who go and identify the invasive species and help deal with them and manage them. So there's this ridiculous article out of Florida that talks about how to solve the invasive species problem. And they have a creative way. We're just going to eat them all, right? We're just going to eat all the invasive animals.
Yeah, it's very ancestral, just going back to our, you know, our caveman ancestors and just eating the available things to us. So they put a whole list of which of these invasive species are actually edible and their recommendations on how to eat them and make sure that you cook them safely. And I've had a few of these.
Like so, what?
So I've had the feral hog, which I call spicy bacon. That tastes just like pork, but the Spanish conquistadors brought a bunch of, you know, domestic hogs to Florida hundreds of years ago, and they just kind of ran wild, but they are invasive. Iguanas, the green iguanas.
No.
I have these in tacos, and everything is good in a taco. So, lionfish, I have not eaten a lionfish, but I've heard they're pretty good. I can't imagine how much meat you can get off of a lionfish. Green mussels, I imagine, taste just like mussels.
Wait. And I got to ask, don't list anymore. Is the Burmese python on the list of edible things?
It is on the list, but they advise you not to eat it because the meat is full of mercury.
Okay. Yeah, I just like picture someone with their big, just pictured it. Ugh. No, and the iguanas is sad. You know how much my husband likes the iguanas in Florida. I'm going to tell him not to watch the show today. Because he'll name them when we're out there, and he loves those little buggers. So, all right, if whatever tickles your fancy, okay? All right, Miranda, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know Snake. In Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
You know, I watched that show Naked and Afraid. They eat snakes. If they come across a snake and they skin it, and they rotisserie it. If I was dying, I'd eat a snake, but somebody else would have to kill it and skin it for me because I'm not touching it. It's just disgusting. I hear rain starting again. You know, somebody just pointed out the title of today's show is Democracy Dies in Darkness.
And we went dark.
We were literally in the dark. Gosh, isn't that just perfect? All right, we're going to close the show out with some comments coming up next. First, I've told you guys over and over, take the First Mark Challenge. In fact, I just had a nice little email from First Mark today. They were just checking in. How's everything going with the business? And checking in on a few things, making sure no updates before some of my annual renewals. It's just so nice. The service is so nice. We hear a lot of good things about First Mark from all of you who have taken the First Mark Challenge. For some of you, taking the First Mark Challenge has saved you thousands of dollars a year. Yeah, you're welcome. Eric said that he stopped being a freeloading listener and only watching our free episodes because he saved so much money with First Mark. He saved 30% on his auto policy and 70% on his homeowner's policy. So as we shamed him on the show and said, well, then you can afford not to be a freeloading listener. And so indeed, he has become a paid subscriber to Undivided, which we like to hear. But First Mark's great. They just have an exceptional service. And if you can save money on insurance, they're going to find a way. But they also want to make sure that you're properly covered. So it's all part of the process. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. All right, let's get to some comments from you guys. You're so funny. And sorry about the show poll. Look, it's been a day, okay? No show poll today. I don't need you to tell me. I already know. It's been a day. It was a night. We got very little sleep. And then, of course, God wanted to strike Washington State and put us off the air. Sergeant Pickles, don't care if it takes every weekend working overtime. My kids will never set foot in a Washington public school. Good for you. Matthew Cook, $20 super chat. Nice. Brandy and Nicole, thank you for your service and keep reporting what's going on in the Olympia cesspool. You're welcome. Sometimes it's real soul-sucking. The Reaper's son, Orcutt, presented an example of a lewd book material on the floor and the speaker cut him off. If it's not good on the floor, why is it okay for kids? Exactly what he told the Speaker of the House. Just wild. Barron says he disagrees with me on what? Voters put these lefties into office. A lot of lefties don't have kids. They don't care. 500,000 signed the initiative. Dems have more voters. Then let's see, I guess, right? Let's get, if they pass it, there's going to be an initiative, and it's not going to be an initiative to the legislature. It's going to be an initiative to voters. So let's see how many sign it and how it ends up in November. Michael Berta, Brandy, you care about kids more than any other non-parent I have ever talked to. Nicole, too. Thank you for all you do. That's because when I peer into the eyes of my dog, I think, oh my gosh, imagine how much I'd love you if you were a human child. This is how much I love you now. If you were a human child, so then I start to understand how much you must all love your children. Let's see. Papa Woody, Jim's an awesome dude. Yeah, Jim's, I love fighting with Jim too. He's the only one who'll come on and spar with me and still come back.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean?
He takes no offense.
100%.
All right, we disagree. Let's go.
Let's see. Merwin Wren. We need a full voter registration to ballot archive audit in this state and find all vulnerabilities, risks, and impact of the current system. Krista also comments on Orcutt's amendment. Too graphic for the House floor, but perfectly acceptable for teenagers. Do they even freaking hear themselves? Well, you could kind of see the guy who was standing in as House Speaker being like, he knew when it came out of his mouth he was going to get criticized for it. He's like, will you please avoid such graphic depictions? He knew. John Lapp, hello, John, has been so interesting watching Brandy's awakening over the years. I love that she's fighting the good fight, but we had to leave after COVID. Yeah, it's been quite a quick awakening. A lot of threats out really there against little old me lately.
It has been fun to watch, though.
I'm sure it's been fun.
I have to say, can I tell them that when we first started the show, you said...
No, don't tell him that.
Yeah. You're like, I'm not talking to Trump even if you get him on the show. And I was like, yes, you would. And she's like, well, maybe. And now.
That was after Jan 6. It was after he lost. It was before I was red-pilled. Now I'd love to get him on.
You were just annoyed with him at the time. You weren't in the high.
A lot of people annoy me. A lot of people annoy me. But yes, we'd have him on if he wanted to come on now.
It's been a quick awakening.
Yeah. Woody, we ain't down with Nick Brown. This is levity.
Don't ask me, I'm terrible.
This is the age-old tactic of throwing the first punch and then someone retaliates, but only after the second hit is seen and then claiming victim. I wonder what that's in reference to. Old age tactic of throwing the first punch and then someone retaliates, but only the second hit is seen and then claiming victim. I don't know what that's regarding.
Everything.
I read it anyway. I feel like I missed one super chat. Gray Matter. Jim is wrong about motor voter. Two types of license enhanced. License registers to vote and requires proof of citizenship. Normal license doesn't. So enhanced license. But a lot of that's not required yet, right? Or if you go renew, well, it will be.
Yeah, next
and then
month.
It does require proof of citizenship.
Oh, actually, no,
Is he saying?
Yeah, that might be.
That
what
would
he's
make
saying.
Sense because it's enhanced, right?
But I don't think it's required. It won't. It's required to fly, but right. It's not required to have.
Interesting, because whenever I go through TSA with my old ID, they hand me a little flyer that says, "Reminder, enhanced ID." And I'm like, I don't want another flyer. I already have some. I'll do it eventually. I don't want to get a new ID because I look so young and slender and in my. I had a bad day at the DMV, so I'm like, in my photo. But I don't want to update,
It is a very good photo.
It is a good photo. Although my hair is just bleach blonde. It is stick straight, bleach blonde. I had some bangs. Yeah. But I don't want to get rid of that photo. Although, I don't know. Maybe it's time to grow up a little bit. Okay. The next one I'm going to keep for life. All right. I think we're going to end the show there before the power goes out again. We will have a new episode of Sundays with Subscribers. It's interesting. We're going to be joined by, is he CEO of INRIX? Owner of INRIX, I don't know his exact title. He made headlines recently for saying that he was going to leave the city of Kirkland over the installation of a new homeless camp that he says puts the safety of his employees at risk. So we're going to have him on the show to discuss it. We'll have a new episode of Politics Unpacked tomorrow. Subscriber episode on Sunday. Back with the rest of you on Monday. If you, too, are a freeloading fan of Undivided, we still love you, obviously, but we would love for you to become a paid subscriber. It's how we continue to do this show full time. It's what allows us to stay up until the wee hours of the morning listening to the nonsense being pushed in Olympia so you don't have to. If that's not worth $5 a month, I don't know what is. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. Thanks for sticking with us through our challenges today. We do appreciate it. That's it. That's really all I got. Have a great weekend. Don't get struck by lightning if the storm is moving through your neighborhood right now. And that's it. Ta-ta.